Nicaragua. Could you see a moment, now there's mediation that's been set up, where you could accept Nablus as a sister city? What would Esrea's group have to do that would satisfy your concerns?
And Amy, let me make clear, I express only my own concerns. I don't sit here representative of any group or organization. They would have to gut the program of the political advocacy that they engage in. The mayor, in establishing this relationship, said, go home and advocate for Palestine. Project Hope, which is the destination for their volunteers, say, go home and advocate for Palestine. Esrea Sharon is on record of saying, we're in this to present a one-sided perspective and to end the occupation. And back home, that's exactly what we hear from the volunteers. That's our end of the exchange, is tales of the occupation.
Bruce,
and,
let me ask you
something. I did teach a bit.
Would you be for the end of the occupation? Would you support the end of the occupation?
Yes.
And well, let me end with Esrea. How many other...
It depends how it ends.
Let me end with Esrea. How many other cities in the United States are sister cities with Palestinian cities?
There's four cities in the United States that are sistered with Palestinians.
They are?
Yes. They are...
Among them?
Yeah, there's Gainesville, Florida, that also has a sister in Israel. And there's Cambridge, Burlington, Sacramento. They're all sistered with Bethlehem.
I'm going to leave it there. Okay. It's an interesting discussion. We'll continue to follow it because it's being mediated in Boulder, and it's clearly going to go on. That does it for our show. Thank you so much to Esrea Sharon, board chair of the Boulder Nablus Sister City Project, and Bruce Schaefer, attorney and opponent of the proposal. That does it for our show. We're on our 100-city tour. I'll be speaking at Colorado College in Colorado Springs tonight, then Eagle, Carbondale, Paonia, Salida, Taos, New Mexico on Saturday and Sunday. Check our website at democracynow.org. We'll be in Albuquerque on Monday and Santa Fe on Tuesday. Special thanks to Amy Littlefield, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
This is WHFR Dearborn. And now it's time for our public affairs show, and we call it the new WHFR Journal. Hello, welcome to the new WHFR Journal for April the 22nd, 2016. Jay Koronek here along with John Conroy, WHFR Radio News Director, and I'm the station advisor. And it's a very special show today, very, very special show. It is part of our Radiothon 2016, our annual, just once a year, pledge drive where we ask you to call in and donate. Make a pledge to support WHFR, independent, non-commercial, educational, we think, radio station, licensed to Henry Ford College. They don't give us all the money. No, like any real world thing, we're learning by doing. And so we have to raise 60 to 70% of the money that's needed, absolutely needed, to survive here. But it's not hundreds of thousands of dollars. It actually comes to only about $45,000 a year. College pays about $20,000 of that, and we raise the rest through various activities during the year and donations all the time, but also coming in especially this week. This is the big time. And if you are a regular listener to the WHFR Journal, we will take the call right here in the studio, even when our special guest arrives, too. John Conroy will pick up the phone. We're going to have Kitty Love in here in a few minutes after Mayor O'Reilly arrives. That's right, Dearborn's Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr. He's scheduled for about 1:15 today. We're going to cover some stories before then. So what is the phone number in the studio if you want to talk to us? It is 313-317 4132. That's a little different number. It'll get you than we usually use, having a little issues with our phone system. But it'll get you direct. It's a direct line into Studio A. And so we can take your pledge and tell you about incentive items and so on. Of course, if you have a computer, you can go to our website, whfr.fm, anytime. Click on the Radiothon 2016 banner in the center of the page and make your donation there. There's also pictures of the incentives that we're giving you, if you want one, for each pledge level. But any pledge is very welcome. We usually start talking about the $30 level because that's what people like John Conroy have to pay in 1 year. Okay, that's application fees. Our application periods are 16 weeks long, sort of syncing up with the semesters here at the college. And we use that application money, though, folks, for just office essentials. That means, all kinds of supplies, toner cartridges. We had a little computer accessory, a USB hub, that my flash drive is plugged into right now here in Studio A. It stopped working totally. So that was $20 there. But, some of the big costs are our satellite delivery system for Classical 24 overnight and for the NPR programming that we get via that satellite, thanks to another fee that we have to pay. It's about $20,000 a year, $20,000 a year. And then copyright royalties to the performers of the music and the people that write the music for that applies to both when we're broadcasting over FM and when we're streaming. We stream all the time our signal to anybody on the internet. So please call us. That number here, 313-317-4132. Okay, 313-317-4132, and make a pledge of support or go online to whfr.fm. Okay, let's get into the news of the day. Follow-up from last week, got to get this in. The Live Lounge is closed, so they're living no more, if you will. And some of you, like even John afterwards, said, Jay, I saw that on television, like Tuesday before last Friday. And I'm thinking, but it wasn't in the Dearborn papers. It wasn't on their website. And it's true because I didn't check around noon, because around noon of last Friday, it was in the Dearborn Press and Guide on their website, pressandguide.com. However, that was 3 days after the Detroit News had the story on their website. And John told me he even saw on some of the major channels in Detroit, Channel 4 or whatever you were watching.
Two.
Okay. That they actually took some of the video that was shown, I guess, at the console meeting, and played that back. So, is that the kind of local papers you want, folks, that are 4 or 5 days delayed in covering local news, and they're scooped by the big organizations in Detroit? You say, well, they have more reporters and they have more camera crews. And yeah, but it's a big area. But they knew where the action was going to be, I guess. Otherwise, they wouldn't have been there to cover it. And by golly, they did. So normally, I don't even watch. And that's why I didn't know about it, John, because one of my basic principles of life is I don't watch local television news because it's too commercial. It goes with, all the violence and upset. And of course, there was a violence angle to the Live Lounge problem. And so that's, again, that's why it sort of qualified for commercial TV coverage, news coverage, I guess.
Well, and Channel 2 usually has the most sensational news coverage as well. So they're going to cover those kind of
stories. Yeah, being related to the Fox News organization.
Yeah.
Because even the Fox News cable channels also follow the same principle. Because it's ratings. And if it's sensational, whether it's something blowing up or it's on fire or somebody killed somebody or beat somebody up or whatever, or started yelling, they'll cover it. And it doesn't matter if it's relevant or significant. If it's got that violence angle, by golly, it's the top of their list. And that's not what I watch the news for, because I know that those incidents are here today and gone tomorrow. The ones that stay with us are general issues like, healthcare problems, homelessness, hunger, We talked about pantries giving food both here at the college and somewhere else you mentioned too last week, John.
We have the Hawk's Nest
on
here,
campus, right?
On campus, and then we have downriver food pantries as well that are always in use. You know?
I think it's Walmart. I just see that there's a TV commercial that Walmart is doing. It's a bluff for Walmart, of course, but it's a little girl who has a lot of food in the refrigerator, thinking about her girlfriend who has no food in her refrigerator, and the little girl, like 8 or 10 years old, and her mom, then they go to the store and they shop at Walmart's, apparently, and Walmart's contributes to the pantry, free food to the pantry. I don't know if it's based on sales in the area, you know, percent of profits from their local store will go to a local pantry, but they actually had a food pantry shown. And, of course, the little girl and her mother, who didn't have as much food, were there collecting food. And, of course, it ends with the little girl that has food and the little girl that was hungry, both smiling and sitting together in the school bus on the way to school. So a wonderful story there. But there's a need for pantries, obviously. And even it's a national recognition if Walmart's going to include it in their spots.
A need for donations as well as a need for volunteers to man those pantries.
That's right. And we have a need for donations here at WHFR, 313-317-4132. It's our Radiothon 2016 week. It's the only time in the journal we're going to be asking you, taking up any time at all. So I'm sorry that I didn't check in minutes before our show last Friday to give you the update on the Live Lounge closing. But the papers were way behind. Even the Arab American News, Regan Ford, the gentleman that wrote the opinion paper, gave the impression, and I read it on the air, that he was there at that meeting because he saw videos. But apparently he didn't stay for the whole meeting because they didn't mention, I read the story again, and it didn't mention that the owner came in unexpected to that same meeting and said, I'm canceling the Live Lounge lease. So he didn't catch that. He didn't write about that. It was like, Live Lounge is still a problem. What are we going to do about it? Contact your city council. And that's how he left it. So maybe he was only watching on TV or something. Because if you go to the meeting, you think you'd stay for the whole thing as long as you went to the trouble to drive there. You know. So that's nothing wrong with him. But I'm just saying that's why even the story in the Arab American News from last Friday about Live Lounge was incomplete because Regan Ford didn't stay for the whole time. So let's try to get some reporters assigned to the city beat, and get that news in the weekly papers weekly. What a concept. Especially if it happens 3 or 4 days before the paper comes out. You know, I mean, that seems pretty important. Okay. Now, let me just say that if they had a reporter there Monday night and they wrote it up quick, I bet they could get it for the publishing of the Press and Guide paper Wednesday edition. It would be a little bit of a push, but they could do that. But the person who did write the story, Jody Rampala, I think her name is, the story didn't post on the Press and Guide website until Friday. So somebody made a decision. Maybe she was there at the meeting, you know, and then wrote it up. But they decided, well, it's too close to the Wednesday publication. You know, we already got the front page set up or something, so we can't put it in. So we'll just put it on the Sunday paper. And so that's why it didn't get in. But maybe Jody was actually there, but she easily could pick the story up also from the Detroit News website. Okay. Story number two. We mentioned a lot of people running for the primary, and now it is passed. It is past the deadline, although not the deadline. Apparently today is the deadline to take your name out. So 4:30 today. So maybe some of these people are take their names out, but we know who's going to be running in the August 2nd primary. Did you catch that? The date of the primary election, where you get the candidates down to the two biggies in partisan races or in the district court race too. That's going to be August 2nd. It's before homecoming. This year, Dearborn homecoming is the 5th, the 6th, and the 7th. So you can't like say, well, I'll go to Dearborn homecoming and I'll meet the candidates and I'll make my decision that way. And then I'll vote the following Tuesday. No. the primary election, it doesn't work that way this year. It's coming up before, the Tuesday before homecoming. So here we go. For George DeRaney's 15th District Michigan State Rep seat, Republicans, there's three of them, Terrence Guido Guerin, Richard R. Johnson, Paul E. Sophia. Democrats, there's six of them. And, of course, in a primary election, all you have to do is get one vote more than anybody else. That's called a plurality. And you're in. So if they split the vote up six ways, if my math is right, that's about 16-17% for each of them. So to win, all you'd really need, if it's split equally, is about 18% of the voters in the primary. And we know there's not that many voters in primaries anyway. So it's not really democracy at work there, folks, in my mind, when that happens. But, I mean, it could be a landslide for one candidate. Who knows?
Does the voter, when he enters the booth, make the choice whether he's going to vote Democrat or Republican?
Yes. Yeah. In Michigan, unlike the state of New York that people might have heard about from last week's election, you can choose, but you have to choose when you go in to either vote in the Republican
one party or
side,
or the other,
or
right.
Democratic party, right? So you can't go back and forth from one race. Although you could be a Republican and vote in the 19th District Court race, or you could have the Democratic ballot and still vote in the District Court because that is nonpartisan. So that's included in both the Republican and Democratic ballots.
But the voter makes the choice of whatever the party is he wants to see. That might be the most
any
interesting
sort of partisan
race.
Contest. They can only choose one side or the other.
Okay.
Yeah, be really interesting if you could vote in both sides. That would be just. I mean, talk about being able to predict it if you're a political scientist. It really would be difficult to do that. I think. I'll tell you the district court nominees in a second. We're welcoming John B. O'Reilly Jr. to the WHFR studios.
Welcome, Mayor.
Welcome,
that's
sir.
Your seat right there. He's got his headphones that he's putting on, and John, show him how he can adjust the volume there if it's good or bad. Good? Okay.
Okay.
Then move the mic a bit closer for you there. Live radio. We love it.
Yeah.
Welcome to the Radiothon Week, Mayor O'Reilly. You always come in the Radiothon Week because we save the best programming for this week.
Well,
and you're certainly the best mayor we have, the only mayor, for almost 20 years now.
Well, I haven't been mayor for that long. I was on the city
since 2007.
Council. Well, that's 20 years? What's your math here?
Oh, 10 years. 10 years. Is that close enough?
My finance
city
director.
Council was almost 20 years. That was,
well, it was, yeah. I,
17
I was,
years?
Yeah, it was 17 years city council president, and then 10 years. So, yeah.
Okay.
Getting up there.
You're getting the hang of it.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, we have all kinds of questions, because on this show, we try to go a little bit in depth. And I gave you a list of the 10,000 questions there. I just talked about, we're going to jump right in, I just talked about the Live Lounge issue. It was, I guess, resolved unexpectedly last Monday at the council meeting when the owner came in and said that the people who had leased the space from him for the Live Lounge, that he was revoking their lease.
Well, there's more to it. It's... We were working for a couple months with him to get to that result.
Ah.
So there were two things going parallel, and they were both very important. The council had to, of course, pursue the only opportunity we have in dealing with Liquor Control Commission is once a year there's a renewal. And if we can show that we evaluate all the bars and we identify those that are out of sync, we can recommend they not be renewed.
Okay.
But it's a challenging process. So we went through and did it with all of the bars in Dearborn, determining their compliance. And then that was a hearing that would have resulted in a recommendation based on the council's examination to the State Liquor Control Commission that business should not be allowed to continue to have a license.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one process. The other process was trying to negotiate. We had a broker that had an interest, but there was an unrealistic expectations on the other side, which isn't a surprise. It happens a lot. And so I was meeting with them to talk about, you know, what's the best solution here? What's the best way for everyone to come out? And that's what happened. So the two things were important pieces of the same outcome. And so now we have it moving into a new owner who has a whole different view and who's going to consolidate the property. So I can't comment because they're not closed yet.
I see.
But it's a good solution. Very difficult process, though.
Does the license transfer from one owner to the other?
It can be transferred. In this case, the three partners had actually invested in the building.
Liquor license, we're talking about.
And then they split off. Oh, so liquor licenses are transferable. Well, there's different kinds because there's some that are assigned to the property, and there are some that are assigned to the person and are portable. But this was one that was to the person and portable.
Okay. Okay, so just wax poetic here, or philosophic, if you think it's appropriate. What do you think is behind the violence in some clubs, like over the last year or so? Well, there has been coverage, kind of spotty. It's not that many times or in that many people, but apparently Dearborn police are have been kind of stretched some weekends in Dearborn trying to cover these things.
Well, I think that's a little bit overstated, but, you know, people like to do things for effect. But the truth of it is...
not me. I'm just saying that
the
papers...
I understand.
The papers,
well,
of course.
Well, the papers are printing what somebody else said.
Oh, yeah.
But what's really been going on, and this is something that we are trying to deal with, but it really needs to be dealt with in Lansing legislatively. What happens is there are bars where they assign the operation to a manager, but there's no regulations on the manager, and I'm asking now, and I'm asking Lansing, our legislators, to change this so that you cannot, if you are the liquor license holder, you cannot let somebody come in and manage the business for you if they wouldn't be eligible, based on the requirements, to be a owner themselves. Because what happens, even within a family, you have a family where the male member is running the bar, but would not be eligible because of their background check. So they have their spouse have the name of the license is in the spouse's name, but they're not the operator. We need to close that. In this case, what's happening is bar owners, in order to make money, are having a manager or a group come in and bring with them a large contingent, but it's a kind of specialty thing, high end, they're paying a lot of money to come in, but they're an element that are higher risk. They're more likely to be carrying guns. They're more likely to over imbibe. There's a lot of things with that group, and they're an imported group. They're coming in. They're not normal customers, and not people come here. They come here as a destination because of the way it's advertised. You know, it's advertised as, you know, I mean, they sell only full bottles of alcohol and stuff. It's a culture that's developed, and it's around Detroit.
So if those regulations were changed at the state level, licensing regulations for a liquor license, then that would help in enforcement?
Well, yeah. Well, actually, it would mean that they couldn't have a person managing the bar who wouldn't, in their own right, be eligible because of actually usually criminal activity in the past and so on. That's one of the biggest bars.
Okay.
So these people have criminal activity in their past, and yet they're operating a bar. It's not what's intended by the state law, but it's one of those things that needs to be addressed.
I read that some of the city council members, maybe this meeting and maybe the last meeting, they felt, it was just not a majority opinion, I don't think, that the clubs themselves should police the violence or the potential, like more security guards of their own, bouncers or whatever. And I don't know whether these establishments actually had those people or not. I mean, there should be somebody checking the ID at the door for the age coming in.
Yeah, they do that and so on. But it really isn't so much, these aren't so much young people where age is the biggest issue. It's what their expectations are coming in, what kind of environment is being created. It's an environment, you know, that has some intensity. I'm being kind, but that's the word I would include. That's the problem. None of these, and we've had the situation over several years now where it's gone from one place will shut down and it'll go to another one and so on. But the heart of it is this is a crowd that's going to be rowdy and and going to be packing, and we really don't see that there's any value in them being here. We can't say they can't be, but we can say that the people who are operating here have to be responsible, and they should be people who would be eligible to operate a bar on their own, because if not, then that's what's the point.
Well, WHFR, we just had a fundraising blues jam last weekend at New Place Lounge in West Dearborn.
Right.
Everything was fine, and
yep.
There's nothing rowdy,
right.
I should just say. So it's not all radio stations co-sponsor something that's rowdy. No, I'm sorry. WJOB. Sorry about that. It was just an accident. So more police is not the answer. And in fact, this may just be a... from year to year, there's sometimes occurrences of these minor disruptions, and certainly it's not a major problem every weekend in the majority of, or the vast majority of restaurants and clubs in Dearborn.
But it definitely can have an impact if it's not addressed.
Okay, John.
Mm-hmm. Is there a space requirement between bars or places of like that in Dearborn?
Not in the downtown areas, but it is. We have regulations that say they can't be within so much distance of each other, distance of a school, or that kind of thing. But in the downtown districts, that's usually waived because the downtown districts don't usually have the schools and neighborhoods right on there.
Okay.
Because I just wonder if there's a spillover sometimes if there's a violent problem in one place, if it goes outside, then the next bar that's there might see that and want to investigate to see what's going on.
No, because these people come into a destination, and we haven't really seen it spreading to other places. It's localized to the place that's advertising and marketing a certain type of environment for that night.
Ah, okay.
Let me just jump to something a little further down my list, but it has to do with crime. You reported in your State of the City address that serious crimes are down 6.5% in the last year, or the last period, whatever the period was. But what about minor crimes? Is that minor crimes, disturbances at a bar or something?
It's more like theft from automobiles, that kind of stuff. And what we did a big thing, lock it or lose it, and because what we found out is, Sunday morning, people went out and found their cars, stuff had been stolen out of their cars, but when we looked at the data, it showed that the majority of those, the cars were not locked. So
that's a minor crime?
Yeah.
In the category? Okay.
Yeah.
So minor crime, has that gone up, even though serious crimes have gone down?
It went up. It was up. Actually, it was going on, and when we finally got to messaging the right information to our citizens, we've seen it drop dramatically.
Because car theft,
because these are generally people who aren't going to break into the car, generally. They just go down and check every door to see if there's an open door. But if they get in the open door in today's car, you can get into the trunk. So,
Well, I have to say, I don't usually do crime news at all on this station, but we just wanted to get the update, really, on that situation. So we're jumping to something that's not crime-related, but it is a crime we're committing on our own planet. Earth Day is today.
Yes.
Happy Earth Day.
Thank you.
Okay. And I know as part of your State of the City address, this was on February 24th of this year, by the way, folks, and our podcast for the Journal is still online. It'll be there for a couple of years, in fact. It's from 2/26. Just 2 days later, we broadcast the entire State of the City address. So you can go to WHFR.fm and listen to that if you'd like to. But and by the way, it was a great presentation, very comprehensive, and you had, was it six people that also helped with individual information? One of them, Dave Norwood, is the sustainability coordinator for the City of Dearborn, right, Tyler?
Yep.
And is it true he doesn't get a salary?
No, we sustain him also.
Oh, okay. He actually said on the show he doesn't get a salary. That was a couple years ago. That he was just surviving on grant money, coordinators from grant.
Oh,
but
maybe his situation has changed.
No.
The question, I think you may have not been in the wrong context.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, we're saying to him, his department needs to as much as possible, be funded by grant money, and he's done that very successfully.
Oh, yeah, I know, yes.
He gets a pay.
He gets
a good paycheck.
That's always good. And I should say, I think that's the sort of the model that I think there was questions about paying a key person at the Dearborn Historical Museum, the curator,
oh, yes,
and this year in your budget, proposal
full
next
time,
year, full-time. And was it halftime before?
Well, it was
for a while.
There were some part-time people that got part-time pay, but to manage that effectively and to really do the kind of job we'd like to see, you need someone who's there full-time because also we have a lot of volunteers, but there has to be someone to supervise the volunteers and so on.
Right,
so.
And coordinate the fundraising efforts.
Right.
It looked to me like it said and I actually yesterday read the proposed budget from the city, which is available on their website, cityofdearborn.org, folks. A number of budget hearings coming up that are scheduled. You can attend in person, too. But it said that the revenues for the historical department are $256,000. It says that those revenues came from Guild.
Well, it's not revenues the city controls, but the Guild itself is the arm of... It is not a city operation, but it has revenues that were conveyed to them. For example, the sale of Andiamo's, that property is for them. So the revenue goes to them, and so they support it.
It's a pool of money.
Right.
Okay.
And so, but it's money that they control, mm-hmm. but on behalf of the museum.
Well, if I may say just a point that you also made at the beginning of the State of City Address, one of your main themes was collaboration, and you pointed out there's at least, I think, 230 volunteers helping the city in some way, commissions and all kinds of, but certainly there's a lot of volunteers, I assume you're kind of the people who are helping the Historical Museum to raise money. Or maybe you didn't count them,
not really. These were people who like volunteer and being on commissions,
officially
making decisions,
appointed by you.
The Zoning Board of Appeals. All these people mm-hmm. who put in their own time, and they are the ones who are responding to requests or things from our citizens and their fellow citizens. So it's a good model because this isn't somebody who's paid to be there. It's somebody who's saying, "I want to be here because I want to make sure we get it right."
It's almost like a quasi government employees. That's QUASI. Didn't say crazy, okay. But because they're in fact pretty well skilled. I mean, you don't appoint them if they don't have the right backgrounds and knowledge, and yet they're doing it for nothing.
So
John.
That's
right.
So there we are, John.
John Conroy next to John O'Reilly.
But, mm-hmm. That's why I had some of them participate in the State of the City because I mm-hmm. wanted the average citizen to understand how much benefit they get actually from fellow citizens who are willing mm-hmm. to step up.
And of course the Dearborn Animal Shelter, the Friends of the Dearborn Animal Shelter, and their name may be changed, but I don't know where that is.
It's
was a little to do in the paper.
Yeah, well, that's what happened is they did doing business as so you can have a business and this is the name of the business, but you can go and register another doing business as so that you legitimately can reserve that. So they did that because they're concerned that their reach goes well beyond Dearborn.
Absolutely.
And
yeah.
this is right now with the council a little a little bit controversial, but I think we're going to work through it all. I mean, they're not changing their model, but they recognize that a lot of their volunteers and a lot of their contributors are from outside Dearborn, and they don't want them to feel like they're not part of the process. So it's an issue that'll be sorted out, I think, very, very well, but it is one where you go, okay, but we've made commitments, and every city has to have some way of managing stray animals, every city.
Yeah.
So this is something every city does. With us, we contract with them to do the service for us. We pick up, we're out in the streets, but they're the ones doing it.
But it saves the city an awful lot of money to have this other group doing this.
Right.
Of course, they raise so much money on their own that the amount the city pays them, it's a relatively small part of their budget.
$85,000.
Yeah, $85,000. Well, it's not small, but it's...
Well, it is
by
if
compared
you think
to
about
all,
staffing.
Yeah,
you start looking at paid staffing, and
And they have a lot of volunteers, too, probably not... Yeah. Part of your official 230, but they have a lot of people. There was one couple that John and I mentioned on the air. It was amazing that they got recognized by the people at the shelter because they put in 1,000 hours last year. That's over 20 hours a week. So, wow, that's really nice. And if you have a cause like that, there's a lot of nonprofits, including WHFR, although We ask you to take a class first so you know what you're doing here before you get on the air, which knob to push, you know, and or pull or whatever. Okay. So, but the volunteer is an important story, and historical department seems like from your proposed budget is going to be, if approved, of course, is going to be pretty well set, better than they were, and they're on a pretty straight path now.
Yeah, and they have a real vision for where they want to go, so that's a great organization.
Just a few more beer tasting events, and they'll be up and running for years. No, those have been one of their more successful events. They surprised themselves. I think they did two last year. It was so big. Okay, moving down the list. So Earth Day, any new initiatives? Because I listened to Dave's report. It was things I'd heard before, but
solar capture is one. We'll have one of the largest municipal solar captures because the whole roof of the Ford Community Performing Arts Center and the parking lot between the center and the police station are all going to have solar capture.
Oh, that's great.
So it's going to be really good. And actually, there's no cost to us. We have someone who will get credits for that, so we'll get the energy. We'll get a small payment, about $25,000 a year, but it'll help defray some of our costs. But it's also not going to. There's no investment of public tax dollars going into it.
Mm-hmm. In the last couple of years, Mayor Guido's term, he was tossing around an idea for a wind turbine farm located somewhere, but of course it would take upfront money to build all that, I don't know if it's going to kill any birds or not, but from the propellers going around. But that's a problem with municipal work like that. It might have payback eventually. But solar these days looks like, and this is just a word to our listeners too, that even in Michigan, it's going to pay for itself rather quickly. I mean, it used to be like, well, maybe 10 or 20 years, but in 3 to 5 years, depending on if you're in a good spot in access to the sun. And the panels are, in some cases, I know there's a company in Michigan making roofing materials that actually absorb the heat. Yeah. And so it looks like you're just putting a new roof on, sort of.
Yeah, well, it functions just as a roof, and it looks like a roof, but it is actually a solar capture. And so that's right here in Midland. So it comes out of Midland, Michigan.
Yeah. And of course, the other thing, too, is if you have solar only, you usually would need, unless you have power coming in other sources, like the center would have power coming in normal ways, they just wouldn't use as much during the day. But if you wanted to save that extra energy, then you need a battery to store it with. And Tesla, the car manufacturer, they apparently have a really good one for only $3,000 that can be that can run your whole house overnight if you had a sunny day that day.
Right.
So that's pretty amazing that you wouldn't be really using from the so-called grid from the outside sources at all. So maybe if batteries improve, that's something for all of us. Well, I know the city's going to keep going at that, because it saves us money. Maybe I should jump down to jumping over to John here. He raised his hand.
All right, there you go.
Just a good teacher. I recognize people when they raise their hands.
So, most of the time.
Most of the time. Sometimes not.
I was just, when you were talking about solar capture, I was wondering if you were involved at all with Ford's new campus plans.
Well, yeah, we have been. We've been working with them for quite a few months on the background, but it had to be all hush-hush because they didn't want anything coming out earlier than when they wanted to. It's exciting. I mean, first of all, you know, as someone who has lived in Dearborn all my life, but also is responsible for its future, at least at this point in time, this is huge because, you know, most of their facilities were aging in place, and we were hoping that we'd see some sign that they were, you know, committed that this is where they plan to be for a long period, and that sign has come in spades.
That's such a
mess. I mean, this is such a huge project. It really is almost all the major properties that they own are going to be completely transformed. But so is their campus and everything. They're going to have one of the kind of coolest environments for working. It's going to be following all the most recent trends in terms of, you know, what's the best creative environment, what kind of tools, what kind of connectivity do you need. This has all been researched. So It's going to be a big investment. They're going to be bringing a lot more employees back here to Dearborn, so we're going to see more activity from that. Mm-hmm. Their investments are amazing. You know, their old steam tunnels, just to give an example how cool it is, their old steam tunnels that connected all the buildings at the engineering and design, they're getting away from steam, but they're going to use them as communication conduits where they'll put lighting in, natural lighting will come in, and you'll be able to bike or walk or whatever underground all year between the buildings, which, think about it, that's just so cool when you're thinking, hey, I got to run over to building B, but no problem, man, I'm taking my bike.
When I was first hired here at Henry Ford College, we had those tunnels here, then faculty on rainy days, we walked through them because they're so big, they were big, and they had some wiring up above and that, but one faculty member about 1972 slipped and fell in a little puddle of water, and so they closed them all down.
Oh, yeah.
So now we have to have an umbrella with us.
See, if between since buildings, you have Henry Ford in your thing, the legacy is that he was big on on a lot of different things.
Well, I have to ask a serious question, and
is there one that hasn't been serious yet?
Oh, very serious. No, I have a funny one coming up next about Ford.
Okay.
First of all, have they started negotiating about a reduction in their future taxes for this investment?
No, that hasn't come up. I don't know. I mean, I can't say there won't be anything, but I think that really for them, they're looking at and I will say this because this is a college campus.
Yeah.
One of the drivers of their commitment and what they're doing is to create an environment that'll be attractive to the talent they're trying to recruit. And one of the things that's recognized, and we know it everywhere, is that instead of industry-specific talent now is a much broader profile. People who are learning how to develop and create technology, how to apply technology in new ways, are in demand everywhere, in every industry. So now it's they're the ones who drive everything. They come and interview with you and say, well, you know, Jay, this is kind of interesting. I'm in this place. I tell you what, I'll try you out. I'll agree to come here for a year and see if it works out. I mean, that's where some of these young people are at in terms of the bargaining. And so the companies are looking at how do we create the environment and the lifestyle opportunities that are going to attract that talent.
Well, they probably have examples from either the Apple, Apple and Google campuses.
Yep. A lot of discussion about Google and some of the successes they've had.
They need
had.
The same kind of innovative thinking in many ways.
Absolutely.
Okay, here's the more humorous insight. I certainly hope that Ford, for that campus, and they talked about having maybe automated cars and shuttles between the different buildings. I hope they're not going to use, like, the monorail they put in back in 19 whatever it was from the old Hyatt Regency to Fairlane Town Center, and that they happened to forget about Michigan winters having ice and snow, and that when the little car, which didn't run on rails, you know, I think you probably remember, it just had little wheels, and so on a little sort of enclosed highway above the ground, and so when ice and snow got there, they had no way other than sending people out on that long monorail to shovel all the way, shovel them out, and even then it was still too icy, and they finally took it out. I mean, how Ford engineers then didn't allow for that monorail to operate in Michigan winters boggled my mind. So an automated car, is that good on ice and snow?
I just want to help you with one thing.
Okay,
though.
I'm just thinking of these crazy
things.
While
that was a challenge, challenge was easily going to be able to be mitigated because they knew what they had to do to change it. But the real reason that it failed is that the hotel, which thought it'd be cool to have their people be able to get to the mall, forgot about everybody at the mall was coming over just to look. Okay. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden, their guests at the hotel were complaining that we can't get into the restaurants. We'd have nowhere to sit in the lobbies.
Tourists.
Because all these tourists have come
tourists,
over.
Yeah.
Right. Coming over just to check everything out and sit around and whatever. So that was was one of the drivers.
In the rest, except for those few winter days.
So I agree that they had two problems. One, the original design was flawed, and then the original concept was flawed, too. They forgot that it isn't one way from the hotel convenient over to the mall. It's people at the mall conveniently coming over.
Because they actually were talking then that Ford is going to be more, I mean, this is like four decades ago, Ford was going to be into mobility and urban transportation solutions in addition to cars.
Yeah.
And as soon as this failed, it seemed like, oh, we're going to go back to cars.
Well, it's all mobility now.
I know.
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Because they're you know, on that campus, they're going to have, you know, self-driving cars. They're going to have all kinds of stuff. So it's good. This is all about mobility and preparing for the future.
Well, it'd be great for the city of Dearborn. Of course, we don't get their personal property taxes because those are being reduced to nothing. And so anything inside those buildings, I mean, computers, furniture, whatever, that used to be taxed and the money coming back to the cities, that's not going to happen
right
by the time it's built. So that might have been one reason they decided to build in Dearborn, though, because of that. Or
well, they still pay tax on the buildings and property.
Sure. Yeah, I know. That's going to be good. That's going to go up in value, certainly.
Their investment is certainly going to take it up.
That's going to be great. And, again, folks, you can see what's happening. Where our special guest here is Mayor John B. O'Reilly, Jr. of the city of Dearborn today in our Radiothon 2016 Pledge Drive Week. And one of the key factors here is how much negotiating you and others of your administration, too, have to do on all these issues behind the scenes. A lot is going on that people don't find out about.
Yeah.
And I actually blame, I know you said you can come back on this show anytime, but I sort of blame the local newspapers or the dilemma they find themselves in. We don't have enough reporting on the things that are going on that's really sort of public knowledge. I mean, that, you know, we're working on a process. Sometimes you're negotiating, you can't talk about it until it's done. But, you know, stuff is happening all the time in many areas. If people get a chance to read the whole proposed budget, they'll see the breakdown by the different funds or the different areas, like facility fund is the improvement for the buildings. And there's so much really going on. A lot of it very technical or legalistic in statement and the way it has to be stated, but it's fantastic. So I want to mention as next on my list, the combined sewer overflow project, one of our topics for, 20 years now? First of all, how's it going? When will it ever be done?
I think 2028 we get close to being done. But what you have to understand is it's no longer what we, before I became mayor, we were keeping the runoff water and the sewer in the same place and treating it all as sewage. We now have separated everything. So what happens now is instead of building these big containers, you know, 150 feet down into the ground to hold the water until it can be sent for treatment, we're diverting the stormwater at the front end so it never gets contaminated by the sewage. It goes right into the river, and we reduce the amount of sewage that has to be treated. That's a cost savings. On top of that, by doing it this way, we get every area we do, you get new road, you get new sewer lines or water lines. You get water lines that go up that were 6-inch lines. Now they're 8-inch lines, better pressure. And so everything is new, the whole underground. It's like you moved into a new community that was just built, if you're looking at from the street.
So as long as we have the cost, and this was an idea that you began with your administration, is to combine these projects, and because we had the infrastructure need anyway, like most cities do, and this was a way, as long as we have to spend the money to go this way, it's going to improve that. So that it does mean we have to close down a few roads every now and then when they redo the roads as well as the sewers, but it's nice to know they're going to be. So when it is completed, does that mean we'll have reduced water sewage bills?
Reduced sewer bills, because the sewer bills will be you know, based on consumption. Now, I've got another plan that I've been working on for 4 years. Everything takes time.
Oh, yeah.
Because we have a new water authority. You know, Detroit Water and Sewer has been turned over to an authority. Mm-hmm. And they're working very hard to get everything on board. But what I've pitched to them, and I'm still pitching to them, and I'm even saying let Detroit be part of it, I want to do a pilot to show how we could take now this much denser mass of material and convert it to energy instead of taking it, down. I mean, people, if you have an easy or a delicate stomach, don't listen.
Uh-oh.
I mean, our sewage goes down to the Detroit waterfront, and it goes on to a conveyor belt where it's heat kilned so that they get all the water out. They dry it out, they put it in trucks, and they take it to a landfill.
Uh-huh.
This is not a good long-term thing. So I'm proposing that Detroit, and they can even use the Baby Creek facility in Detroit. We take the mass, we take the sewage, convert it to energy, and right there you have Ford Motor Company and AK Steel. You'd have no transmission cost. It'd be a great experiment because those plants that are doing the current processing are aging in place. They're going to need to be replaced. Mm-hmm. And why continue to do that when we can divert it and do something better? So, I mean, they
so
have
the science of it is that the sewage, if the water comes out, it burns, or is it the methane
it's
gas?
It's converted to gas. It's converted to gas. Okay. And as we take out the storm water, that's what I said. Now it becomes a denser mass, which produces better value in terms of the energy. So that's one of the projects I'm really pushing. I'm trying to get interest because it would at least it gives us a chance to examine a different way of treating our waste, which would actually produce value instead of just being
because the cities downriver would definitely support that as far as trucking and traffic on the roads goes. And that's great.
Would you make a brief comment about our water quality? I did see an official press release and a story in the paper a couple weeks ago from the city of Dearborn that, of course, the quality of lead in our water supply is very, very low. Well, he's nodding his head, so he agrees. Yeah. But and so there's nothing to worry about in that regard. And I think it also talked about copper, that copper was very, very low. That must be, I don't know what sort of health hazard copper is, but it can't be good. You don't want to chew a copper candy bar. But anyway, no, but what
that was scientific.
I know. What about, that sounds like a Bill Nye joke, but what about the pre-1950 lines that come from the street to the house? Now, that's not the city responsibility.
Right.
And those homes, they might have lead pipes.
We're trying to account for that. And right now, they're in no danger because, again, when you use the phosphate, it prevents
the right additives.
So you're okay. The Detroit water system is really a good system, but we have to monitor regularly and test it. Mm-hmm. And the current standard, which is being challenged and I think should be challenged, is 15 parts per billion, for lead.
Okay.
We're at 0.04 parts per billion. But as you said, that doesn't mean universally that's the case.
Right.
What they've been finding around the state, and even in our school district and so on, is that when they go around, everything seems fine except there are always they're finding where there's a place where there's a spigot, there's a water release, but it's seldom used. It's building up. So what we now know is, when I was a kid growing up here in Dearborn, my mother said in the morning, first time in the morning, you better run the cold water for a good while. I don't know if you guys had that, but my mother always said, run the cold water for a while, and then you can drink it, And that was really a good thing for her to say. I mean, I don't know how she's so far ahead of her time, but that really was the right advice. And if you saw, in Flint, they're telling people to run, don't run the water, because that's a good thing now. Mm. Because now the phosphate's in, it's going to get rid of what's there. So one of the things is seldom used water intake pipes are an issue. And you pointed out the other one. Originally, when we had lead pipes, they were eliminated in the 50s, I think, going into house. But then that's when copper came in and so on. So people need to know what they have. Right now, there's nothing that says they have to change, and they're not in immediate danger. But if you're doing some work, I would advise you go to a much more modern product that's not that simply doesn't give off anything. We're trying to work through that because now in knee-jerk reaction, there's some proposals that actually are going to cost a lot of money. And the question is, are they necessary or not? But in East Dearborn, our original underground infrastructure for water and sewer was put in by 1920. Mm-hmm. So I mean, we weren't even a city. So I mean, like I said, it's the Flint issue has raised that. But the one thing that they're not talking about that is really one of the precipitating factors in Flint is the broken funding for all local services, schools, counties, townships, cities. That whole system is broke. And so in order to try and manage to sustain the kinds of services we're required to provide for the citizens, there's a big gap, and so you're going to see, I mean, these cities failing and going into bankruptcy and so on. That's not going to change until we change the funding model.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's why we're going to go to question 13 on my list, lucky number 13. I'm going to jump through a whole bunch, and that was what's in the proposed 2017 budget. It's the last year for the 2017 year, I guess. It's the last year for the 3.5 mil increase that was approved by voters of Dearborn back in November of 2011.
Right.
So 6 years, and so if that goes away, that will be apparently, if I'm reading it right, about an $11 million loss in 2018 and 2019.
In direct revenue and going forward, so it would be ongoing.
Right. Yeah.
But on top of that, the replacement money that is attached to the elimination of the personal property tax, which is another thing,
that
would also go away, so it gets closer to $15 to $16 million a year.
Right. The loss of personal, it really should be called business property taxes, but it's business equipment or taxes, but anyway, it's phasing out, and it's down 37% this year, and the state has this SESA, Statewide Essential Services Assessment, which is trying to make up for a little bit of the loss.
Well, pretty substantial a bit. We approved a ballot initiative to take money from the use tax collection, which is mostly affects businesses, and take that money to reimburse local governments for the losses. Okay, so the state did set that up. So I want to be really fair.
Is that the SESA?
Yeah. Well, that's part of it. The SESA is what the businesses still pay. So they're not walking away from all the responsibilities on the personal property tax, because the SESA is something they pay to the state directly, but it goes into the state general fund. This can get so complicated. I don't want to go there because it would just baffle everybody. But anyway, what really is the situation is that we lost almost every local government. And if you'll indulge me for a minute, I just want to help people understand. Back in 1894, the first statewide tax was property tax. And it was created for local governments to be able to build infrastructure to support all the people who were coming here and, you know, making their homes and stuff. Okay, that was fine. But what happened is every time they had a local thing, they added them to the property tax. So you added schools. Then you add, of course, townships were always in, cities. Then you had parks, certain larger parks. Then you have the transit system, so, you know, SMART. They get their money from there. And Wayne County RESA, regional education, get their money from there across the state, all this thing. So you have all these people who are relying on property tax, okay? And even to make it worse, with the Headley Amendment, it was decided that we would put some restraints on how much local governments could raise on property tax. And then Proposal A, which was a disaster, was even worse. But when those two things were done, it was based on the presumption by everyone that property taxes would never substantially go down.
Okay.
So when they went down by 25% to 30% in 1 year,
2008.
There was no contingency plans. There still aren't.
Right.
So the state is pretending like the loss of that's all general fund money. That's all we get to do general fund. We can have a sewage millage. We can have a library millage. But everything else comes out of that money, and no one's talking about it. And Flint is one of the examples of this. Mm-hmm. There are cities all over Michigan that can't do what they have to do, and their citizens are going to suffer. And it's because we haven't addressed the fact that, guess what, folks? We made a mistake. We thought that property values would never go down substantially. They did. Mm-hmm. But the irony is, not only have they gone down, but now Proposal A and Headley restrict the ability to grow back.
Even though property values are technically going up, the taxes can't go up as fast because of the Headley restrictions.
Exactly.
This is really the big core, I think, for the budget, because apparently at least by 2018, if not before. I mean, you're looking at it all the time,
right,
in terms of the numbers. We're going to have to make up for the funding. And it would be better, that in this case you just made, which I totally agree with, if we shift from property taxes so much to, well, what are the other two kinds of taxes?
Sales tax and income tax.
Right.
Now, the state didn't get hit by it. I mean, here's the irony. Mm-hmm. The state's general fund comes from sales tax and income tax, okay? Mm-hmm. For 1 year, I think it was 2010, they were down by 9.2%, those revenues. The next year, they were down by about 6%, and then they were back to whole, and now they're above their pre-recession. Right now, all those local entities I talked, all those things, schools, everything, they won't get back to where they were before 2007 for another 10 years at best, and they're still behind because it won't. Yeah. That doesn't account for the increase in cost.
Every April 15th or so, we do a tax show here, and I'm always saying there's got to be a better way than suffering a person that's got two master's degrees to sit there with his computer for 2 days figuring out his taxes. Yes, I could pay somebody else to do it, but that means paying somebody else to do it. I mean, that it's just too complicated for the average person almost, if they're going to deduct something, certainly. And the fair tax was one concept that struck me, but it wasn't so much the details of what that is. It would replace the entire income tax situation.
Right.
But the research they've done on this over like 20 years is that the most stable kind of tax in times of good and bad times economically is the consumption tax, the sales tax, if you will.
Yeah.
You know, and then because people always have to buy things. Maybe they won't buy quite so many things when they don't have the income coming in, but in fact it doesn't drop that much in bad times. And but of course a combination would seem somewhat fair. So I'm sure this will be a healthy debate. We've got to end in about 1 minute now.
Okay.
We've got Highway 61, the best in the blues, coming up today.
Well, let's talk about this again, because we need to.
Yeah,
it's our future.
In this proposed budget statement too, I mean, it does have the wording. It says, because I was thinking, will Dearborn taxpayers be asked to extend the 3.5 mil increase? And the key phrase there was, in your statement, was this is anticipated but not presumed. But certainly there's larger issues, and I've heard them before, and I totally agree that maybe there is a better way, a more secure way for the cities to work this out. And it might not be more total money from the taxpayer, but it would be split up coming from different ways. And those that are making higher incomes would, of course, contribute more.
I just want to say, one of our biggest problems is that we're bifurcated into, you know, federal, state, and local things, and because of that, people only are myopic about what they're in. So the state legislature is consumed with what their responsibilities are, and they're really not as tuned in. And, of course, locally we're consumed with our things. We need to have an integrated model that says, look, the citizens don't care who's providing the service or how it gets done. They want it done. Mm-hmm. We need to work together to come up with a way that can be done that ensures that you won't have winners and losers. You won't have cities that are collapsing because they just can't do it on their own.
Proper protection for those, yes.
We just had the list in the paper today about who's running for 15th District Michigan Rep.
Yep.
And the primary is August 2nd, and there's six Democrats there, oh my gosh, and three Republicans that are going to be sorted out.
Good.
It's too bad that we won't have usually at homecoming we get a chance to meet all the candidates and we get to vote in the primary after that. It won't work that way this year. So we're going to try to have some of those people on the show here. I just want to remind our listeners, too, there's more than Dems and Republicans in November. I don't know who's going to have a better proposal here, but I would actually, you know, it's so hard to get maybe especially term-limited employees to think about the big picture.
That's a whole other topic.
Well, a final word, and thank you so much, Mayor John B. O'Reilly Jr., for coming to the Journal today and our special Radiothon show. We appreciate your time. Keep up the great work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I enjoy it.
Thanks, John.
And we're going now to Highway 61, coming up
Revisited.
Right now.